Hello, welcome to the sixth podcast in the OnFIF focus series on fintech. So far, we have covered a variety of topics, including digital currencies, decentralized ledger technology or blockchain, and regtech. Last week, we examined the impact of fintech with regards to financial inclusion, and we continue the discussion in today's episode with a special focus on Kenya. My name is Oliver Thew. I'm Programs Manager at OnFIF, and it's my pleasure to introduce Wahoro Ndoho, Director General for Public Debt Management at Kenya's National Treasury. Wahoro, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Kenya is often touted as a country that has embraced financial technology and is widely recognized as the global epicenter for mobile money, thanks to the success of M-Pesa, which now has 20 million users in the Kenyan market, and the total share of mobile money transactions and withdrawals has reached 1.8 trillion Kenyan shillings. So what have been the major fintech innovations that have improved financial inclusion in Kenya over the past 10 years?
Yeah, quite apart from M-Pesa, which has really been a foundational technology, it's really what the other product that has sprung from that. Everything from M-Kopa or mobile-based loan products, to the use of innovations around the payment of other financial transactions, bills, telephones, so that essentially it is enabled the access to a vast majority of our population to pretty much transact their business online using the mobile platform. So much so that you could probably say that it is rendered a good section of the economy cashless in terms of its daily interactions in business.
So the M-Pesa platform has really provided an opportunity for various other products and services to be used. What do you see as the driving force behind the innovation in fintech to improve financial inclusion? I mean, is it a lack of traditional banking services? Is it the need to improve inclusion to help alleviate poverty and provide access to accounts and savings? Is it an open regulatory environment where innovation can occur without hindrance? Is it a combination of all of these, or are there other factors that drive this innovation?
I'd say that a combination of all of those, to a large extent, ability, given that for a long time, a significant section of our population were in no way able to transact in a formal economy. The ability to use or to leverage technology to sense ease interaction with a formal economy has been a particularly benefit. Let me also say that the driving force has also been a transaction cost that found in the formal economy. As with most things, especially in the banking sector, that has proven to be very expensive. And so to a large extent made banking products attractive to, I would say, a significant portion. If I would say more than half the population, but the simple fact that by the time your transaction costs were taken into account, very few customers or citizens would find a product that is useful. Coupled with that, it's also been a widespread between our loan pricing. It's been an open secret that loans are way too high. The spread between banks are making on them, I think on average, is about 30% rate of return on their assets, on their balance sheets. That's far too high. And so that burdened a significant section of the population who had bank accounts with those sort of costs. So any innovation, and that's what really been a key part of fintech, is its ability to cater or minimize the cost of doing business of these transactions, to blow it to a point that it actually makes it attractive. And also the convenience. So you've got both convenience and cost falling significantly. Another thing that's been a huge part in its growth.
Certainly, that is an important factor, which we've found in previous discussions, is not only does fintech provide ease of access, but as you said, it can reduce some of the different costs, intermediary costs and transactional costs, which will help or price out people originally and helping them into the system. Another point, how can central banks, treasuries like National Treasury in Kenya and regulators encourage innovation that specifically looks to improve financial inclusion?
Finally, this product called M-Akiba, once you're able to lower transaction costs to fairly low, a fraction of what the traditional costs were, that then it immediately opens it up to a lot more people. And so for central banks and especially capital market authorities, just having a low-cost product, low-cost means for spreading or providing access to the population means that by its very nature, you'll find a lot more people willing to at least attempt to interact with the formal economy. Now, I keep talking about the formal and informal economy because by and large, one of the salient features of the economies in that part of the world is the fact that the informal sector is far larger in some ways than the formal sector. And it really sits at the heart of the reason why if you look at an economy like Kenya and wonder how on earth do people survive. But you look at maybe the levels of poverty and just the amount of development we need to achieve to begin to attain higher incomes. It's the fact that because the informal sector sits outside the taxation and the formal economy, the vast majority of population actually belong to the informal sector. And so an innovation like this has been the first real instrument that is developed in the formal sector, but finds it resonates greatest in the informal sector. So for example, for central banks and even the capital market authority, it has given the average citizen an ability to transact even though they do not have a bank account, for example. And so it reaches a whole set of the unbanked, a section of our population, and gives them the ability and the facility to actually transact both in the informal sector, but also among themselves. It also gives other benefits. And one of them includes saving. One of the innovations around M-Pesa is that other savings products have come where you can keep your money in mobile money and accumulate it over time out of your business. You can, for example, use it to put it into a virtual account, which of course is backed by a real account in that bank. It's created opportunity, for example, to be able to link your physical bank account with the virtual money world so that you can transact moving money from your physical bank account into your mobile money to transact with people who may not necessarily have a bank account. So examples like that have been useful. Another one I can think of is another innovation has been around what you call very short-term loans. So there's a product, for example, that allows the unbanked, not just the bank, the unbanked, to borrow on a daily basis. So, for example, if you've got your small hawker, you're selling wares on the street side, you could borrow £100 today in the morning, use it to transact, and by evening repay it all through virtual money and through mobile money, make your profit out of the net. So basically, arbitraging your business on a daily basis. And a facility like that, for example, is extremely powerful for the informal sector because it's meant that they're able to immediately access funds. The access, there's a whole structure around how they do that. But they're able just to access very small amounts of working capital, turn them around in a day or two, repay the loan, and still end up with a net gain. So in terms of its possibilities, this is really just the beginning. And David Makiba is just one of the big examples of that innovation.
I think that's a very good example that you've shown there of how one product or platform can then have multiple uses, can affect people in a variety of ways, from short-term loans to actually allowing unbanked people access to accounts, all which is excellent and good improvements for financial inclusion. Another thing is that obviously we know that the more people that use mobile money, the more that these companies, the telcos and the financial sector ones are able to build up consumer credit data, which can then be used to market other products. As the ones you've mentioned, so short-term loans. In addition to this, the ability of mobile money and electronic or digital money also means that there is greater transparency and you can keep track of payments. As the Treasury and regulators, do you see the benefits to that in terms of when you bring people into the formal economy, then being able to have tracks of payments? Is that something that will help when it comes to government being fiscally responsible and looking at managing budgets and making sure that there is money kept within the formal economy once it's brought in?
Yes, to some extent. I think its greatest benefit has really been the ability to bridge into the informal sector. Because up to that point, we had no idea. Part of the reason why M-Pesa has been such a salient lesson for us is we had no idea the amount of transactions that were happening in the informal sector. Because by its very nature, they were not necessarily counted in our statistics. But once we started trading and said people had a way of trading that did not necessitate them interacting with the formal banking sector as a necessity, then I think in the last year, half our GDP, half our formal GDP has been through M-Pesa. And even that's basically funds that in a sense have been circulating the economy, but you will not have been able to necessarily capture them in any formal setting. So in that sense, it's also the fact that it's opening a whole new world of possibilities.
That is an amazing thing that's happening. I think recently the Massachusetts Institute of Technology credited mobile money for lifting 2% of Kenyans out of poverty. Obviously for you, it means you can now view all of these different transactions that take place in the informal economy. So what do you think has been the standout macroeconomic impact of this financial inclusion, of this use of mobile money in Kenya?
One is, as I said before, the unbanked have been brought into the formal economy. But secondly, is that it has catalyzed the ability for mobility of capital in ways that we've never thought of before. I'll give you the example. I just gave you the example of the loan, the short-term loans that are available now. Up to that point, the vast majority of loans were stuck in the formal sector. Now, being in the formal sector with its credit regimes and what have you meant that even in the formal sector, the amount of capital is actually reaching the grassroots. was extremely small, because by the time you fulfilled all the requirements of a bank, you could go from, let's say, the top 20% of the population. And I don't think I'm exaggerating, if you don't come down to about 2 or 3%, could actually access a loan product. For example, if you look at a mortgage size of this country, we have 45 million. And the total number of mortgages, I think, is something like 40 to 50,000. That is incredibly small for the population. This innovation of mobile money has enabled what would have been the unseen, the silent majority, to for the first time begin to interact with the formal sector and among themselves in a manner that is fast, very transparent, and potentially for government, is that over time we will then innovate ways of revenue collection in terms of taxation, now that we've brought in this informal sector into the formal economy. So there are many innovations and other benefits. Part of the reason why it's exciting is the fact that as we speak, we know that innovation is built on itself, it feeds on itself. And even Amakiva by itself was just really a natural progression of all these other innovations coming together and asking ourselves in government, how do we make this thing work? The bond market is not only for the 1, 2, or 3%. How do you democratize access to the capital market? And we could only have done that, in a sense, the evolution of this product for about 10 years now. And then we feel like now it's ready enough for uptake in the... Basically, go from treasury straight to the retail and the bottom end of the retail market. There's no capital market structure that needs that ability anywhere in the world. I'm also excited about it.
Yeah, so in March this year, a decade on from M-Pesa, you launched Amakiva, which you've just mentioned, which is the world's first mobile-only government bond. And perhaps just for the benefit of our listeners, you could just explain, you know, basically what is Amakiva, a bit more about the bond itself, and how does it differ from traditional government bonds?
Amakiva is infrastructure treasury bond that is offered directly to retail, directly by the National Treasury, in partnership with the private sector. So what we've done is we've leveraged the private sector's high technology adaptability and response times and efficiencies to partner to structure a treasury bond and in amounts that are accessible to the grassroots. And so Amakiva, basically what it does is the government issues a bond, let's say £1 million bond. So that £1 million bond is issued by the Central Bank of Kenya. But then that £1 million bond is then given to another entity, a financial entity, to, in a sense, chop it up into small amounts of, let's say, £30 each. And then that entity then is the one that then accesses the public. Now, the public can only access that entity by registering through mobile money, and then they're able to buy it in lots of 30. And thereafter, in fact, it's actually £30 in the first instance, and then up to, I think, £10 thereafter. And the idea being that it is issued regularly so that people at the grassroots are able to save by buying a bit of that bond over time. Why is it also particularly useful? One is that it moves the entry point from previously, I think, 50,000 shillings to 3,000 meant that it's accessed by a lot more people. Second part is that the second part of objective of the Amakiva bond was also for the Treasury to source new ways of raising capital, cheaper capital than they've been doing before. So that, for example, the traditional infrastructure bond right now has a yield, the current yield curve for the infrastructure bond is around the 13 to 14%. So it's a very good return, I'm sure, if you're sitting somewhere in London. But if you've got a high inflation economy, that's not high. I think the effective rate is about 3, 4%. But what we realize is the appetite for savings in the retail level, well, people are quite happy with 10%. So the idea, again, the second idea then would be if you can issue a bond at 10%, for which there's a market, and it's not the formal banking market, its uptake would mean that over time we can raise cheaper capital and therefore lower the yield curve. The flip side of that was also we had had a long process of trying to get the banking sector to be more efficient in terms of the pricing of their loan product. But because they kept, for example, their savings accounts or their savings pricing for their savings products tend to be very, very, very low, to a point where it is actually a negative net return to investors. So by pricing the bond at 10%, we're able then to, in a sense, create a product that competes to some extent with the savings accounts in banks, and both to nudge banks to offer more attractive interest rate, but also because we knew that there was a dearth of a product like that in the market. Most people would not keep savings accounts because they worked out that it was a negative return, kept your bank, your savings in the bank. And Sam Akiba then served towards giving Kenyans an opportunity to participate in a product that gives them a positive return. Finally, in terms of financial inclusion, is, as I said, while a large number of section of our population are not banked or do not have formal bank accounts. And Makiba then is targeted at them in that they can buy it using their mobile money. They can retain it in that form because you have that entity that holds it for them and registers and keeps it for them. And over time, they can buy bits more in the sense of the form of savings. And through that, they'd have two things that have happened. One, actually three things. One is they would have entered into formal capital market, either to they were excluded. Secondly, they had a store for wealth in terms of savings, and that gives them an effective positive return. And thirdly, is over time, we aim for it to inculcate financial intelligence in terms of how investments work, how the bond market works. Because standing in the back of this whole system is a number of agents, what do you call them, stockbrokers or stockbroking firms, fairly small ones, but ones that, for example, once you've raised, let's say, your Makiba and you feed the target for you to participate in the higher yielding bond, then this stockbroking firm can be there to advise you that you probably have not graduated from this type of bond. Maybe you should start thinking about investing in the higher bond. And we see that over time evolving into a system for graduating the majority of our population into the capital market in an orderly fashion.
Thank you. That is a very good and thorough explanation of Makiba. As you've said, some great advantages to it. It's opened up the domestic bond market beyond the traditional institutional investors to retail and even individuals. It's basically brought about that ease of access. I also understand that it's helping with the infrastructure project. As you've said, it's hopefully will raise cheaper capital for the government as well. So the initial tranche of 4.85 Kenyan shillings, which is about $48 million, was a pilot that was targeted. I think it was around 50,000 mobile money users with a two-week window. The pilot was a success. Over 100,000 people registered for the auction. The entire issue sold out in 2 days ahead of schedule. The main listing of 1 billion has had a slightly slower uptake. I know the Treasury has extended the sale by 2 months. There's been more interest. What was your experience from the pilot? What lessons did you apply to the main launch? And why do you think there has been a slower uptake on the main issuance? Do you think it's the need to still educate the public? Are there certain political issues that maybe had a sort of temporary impact on it? Or is it something that is just a slower uptake initially and it will build momentum as it goes on? I mean, what do you see as the sort of lessons that you could learn from the pilot and perhaps sort of lessons that can be then applied to this main issuance?
Okay, well, let me start with the second one. First is that, yes, it's the timing of the main launch are obviously challenges with the political competition at hand. But let me also emphasize that this is a program. It's not an event. And it's a marathon and not a sprint. And so we needed to start somewhere. And so, yes, the uptake was slow. So we extended the period. But remember that it's a bond issuance program targeting the common citizen and in ways that it's affordable for them. And so even its slow uptake, as I said, governments are terrible at sprints, but excellent at marathons. So in this instance, we envisage over time, every time we issue, for example, a normal infrastructure bond, we will set aside a component of it for the retail. And over time, we envisage that growing as a share of our normal capital raise. Now, to the second question of the lessons learned and what we learned from the pilot, a huge amount. Let me just pick three. One is that, remember, this is a partnership between, I always say it's the perfect example of a pure PPP. In its original sense, in that the government has sat down to the private sector and said, look, we are good at this. You guys are good at this. Let's work together and you help us launch this product into the market. It is still a Treasury bill. If I say that, it's the first Treasury bond that the Treasury has issued directly in its own name rather than through the central bank. We'll issue the bond, but we need to understand how we translate it from, we exert it from the wholesale, a number less than like 1 billion. To the retail where you can sell it at 3,000 bits. And so several lessons came out of that. One is you needed the ICT system and platforms, both at the stock exchange, because the Nairobi Securities Exchange was involved. In fact, it was a mandated agent. But then also the, what they call the CDSC, the Central Depository System for the retail, for the commercial sector. They needed to work together. And there are two systems. They needed to align and integrate. Then we needed to also get into the picture a liquidity provider who happened to be a bank, could be a bank, but not necessarily, it could even be ourselves, our government. And so for the purposes of making sure it's commercially viable, we also then recruited a liquidity provider who eventually may consider also underwriting future issuances. That is still in debate, but in a sense, a full service provider, so that a commercial proposition, Rabe Makiba was founded on very strong commercial principle. Now, the pilot was really to say, okay, how do you coordinate those systems to deliver the product to the average Kenyan? But also in trying to do that, we know there'll be anticipated challenges. So let's use a pilot to, in a sense, get a good lay of the land, resolve a lot of those challenges, resolve issues of best practice, resolve issues of regulation in terms of how this works, and how do you satisfy the regulator, but also ensuring a robust product that the average Kenyan can be comfortable and confident that it is not only here to stay, but it is good value for money. And that's what the pilot program did. And as I said, we were amazed by the initial response. And might I say that that response can only happen from a population that's already familiar with the concept. So there's a long gestation period before a product is actually useful enough. And in every product cycle, it's very common in a product cycle. Now for M-Pesa, that was a 10-year period before we felt the population is at a place where they are ready to contemplate a product like this. And so from that pilot program, we learned a lot of lessons, both on the system side, but also the outreach, the sales and marketing, and how, for example, what methods were effective than others. And then we learned some interesting ones. For example, when we started the pilot, we thought, look, we need a super-duper call center with all the modern gadgetry there for people to be able to call in. And so we had a rather big budget for that. Interesting enough, once we launched it, we found that the social media was far more effective. Even for the unbanked, it gets a sense of how sophisticated the population was, that by and large, they'd much rather tweet or send in their questions through their social media than calling. So we realized, well, call center is an idea whose time was long past, and that we should really innovate towards where the market is. I also remember that Kenya's population is relatively young, 60-70% of our population under the age of 35. And so great lesson about social media was to realize that beyond the urban areas, in a lot of the peri-urban areas, the average Kenyan nut is far more savvy about social media than we anticipated. And that would have a huge implication for us in terms of how our outreach would be in future. Because social media is extremely responsive. You don't have to wait for someone to call you in. You know their opinion immediately. If they're unhappy about the product, you hear about it. And our responses, therefore, must also mean that even as a government, we need to change our approach to how we interact with the population. And some of those lessons that then that's fed into the main launch. The last one would be the issue of certification of the population. We realized that the pilot that we had a lot of early adopters, as in any population, but that the bulk of them would be even the late adopters and even the laggards. And in that space, then our strategy for marketing would have to change. And now that's when by the time I came to the main launch, we know we are dealing with different types of customers, and therefore we need to, in a sense, differentiate and certify our marketing plans to move this product. So give us another 3 months, and I think we'll have a much better idea about the various types of citizens and what appeals to them. So it's entirely possible, for example, that we will review this product, maybe issue a three-month one for a particular population, you know, and in a sense reflect the bigger broad market. And just try to create the same strata for the retail sector so that it appeals to the different types of investors that could be a particular need.
Sounds like an amazing learning experience from your point of view, I suppose, in terms of how the different consumers are reacting to it. And it's interesting to hear you using social media to market what is a fintech product, really pushing the forefront. In terms of the bond, we will certainly keep an eye on it. I would encourage all of our listeners to go out, read more about EMIC and what the Treasury is doing. Just a few last questions before we wrap up. Do you think that schemes similar to M-Akiba will be adopted widely beyond Kenya? Are there markets where mobile money can offer these different platforms? And have you been interacting with any other government agencies? Have there been any countries that have approached you with interest about this?
Yes. Recently, we were in, I think, Kigali. We had gone to present it. And one of the interesting asides to this is that it has implications for the region beyond anything we could have thought of. For example, in this demonstration we took in Kigali, we had a lot of inquiries from East African, other countries within the region, who were asking, how can we participate in this? Now, a very simple question, but one with huge financial implications, for the simple reason that if you have a product that is attracting other your neighboring countries, that means you're automatically accessing a market beyond your own. And that has huge fiscal implications for the countries and how they interact with the region. So to the question, can other countries learn from it or adopt it? I think it's going to be a mixed bag. My own view is that it's not as easy, and I don't think it's likely to, because the way it's evolved in Kenya has been a perfect storm of opportunities coming together at the right time to make it work. And as I look at other countries trying to do that, you'd have to just a fairly major unraveling of the current financial sector structure to give it space to germinate and grow. I'll give a good example. Even in an economy that, for example, has a very strong credit card system, use of credit cards, mobile money in its current form is a lethal competitor to that. Why do I say that? One is that mobile money here makes its money off a fee upfront and nothing really after that. While a credit card, of course, is the same cost of money on a daily basis. So there's a value day by day from using a credit card system. So to that extent, then, introducing mobile money in an economy like that, it will come up against such huge headwinds that it will be hard for it to gain traction. And I think that's what happened in South Africa. That trying to introduce it after the fact with an established financial sector system made it, I think, very difficult. Ironically, I see M-Pesa and this mobile money working in settings where the financial sector is not as well established. And to some extent, I know that's been the lesson that Vodafone has taken from M-Pesa in Kenya, because I know they have done that in Afghanistan, for example. And that's been interesting, because once they've perfected mobile money in Kenya, I'm told of a story where Vodafone facilitated the Afghan government to start paying its soldiers through mobile money, because the soldiers didn't have any form of bank account. The story, the anecdote goes like, apparently when the first paycheck was sent to the soldiers, there was a near riot from the soldiers, because all of them realized that they were paid a lot more than anticipated. And apparently what used to happen is, in the previous system, the money was given to the commander, who took a cut and then gave the rest to the soldiers. But now that they had a mobile platform that, in a sense, could democratize the distribution of their salaries, they were getting the full salary. And that, in a sense, is a benefit arose from the fact that we skipped intermediaries directly to the end user. And so if you look at the restrictions, I'd say maybe there's more of a rule of thumb. One is that, yes, the financial sector may not be so developed, because if it's developed, it will fight for its own interest. And so that could stunt its growth. But number two, if there is a financial sector, then it needs a regulator who has a very thick skin to shepherd and parent this innovation to fruition. Because unless you do that, then again, the same sector will try and kill it. Thirdly, of course, is the fact that you need a long gestation period for the population to see and internalize the value of a product of this nature. One, it's a virtual product. And so it's really probably one of the best examples of how a virtual product will impact. And that's because on the back end, it is tied very closely to real cash. But it's given confidence to the consumer that even though it's virtual, it's actually backed at the end of the line by real cash. And essentially the government, I always feel like the government is the ultimate guarantor for a system like this, so that the population knows, yes, it will be honored, because the government will make sure it's honored by both a form of banking sector, but the whole business community.
Yes, there really are unique circumstances in Kenya which have allowed this to work. And as you said, be interesting to see where else it's picked up this technology. I think the anecdote of Afghanistan is quite interesting. But again, it shows what an amazing impact fintech can have for financial inclusion. Soldiers now being paid the full amount of money, which they should have been in the first place. You mentioned this idea that regulators need a tough skin or a thick skin. And I think the central bank, yourselves at the Treasury, the Capital Markets Authority in Kenya have taken a really good approach to it. What can you and the other government agencies do to help continue capture the sort of fintech opportunity in Kenya beyond M-Pesa? And what else can you do in terms of increasing investment?
I'd say maybe you've had the fortune of having very good leadership, both in the regulator, but also in the Treasury. As I said, there's a perfect storm or a perfect opportunity to find the right people in place to let something that was completely out of the box, give it room to just grow. One of the things that I actually like about my job is there are times you look at something and your first reaction is to say no, because it's outside your comfort zone. But if you assess it and they say, this product is new, but for the best I can see, it doesn't break any laws. Yes, there are people shouting and screaming that it's probably going to break laws, but as it stands now, it's not breaking laws. It does seem to have an inherent value. Let's just leave it. Let's just see where this goes. And I think a lot of innovations get killed just by the nature of being in an overstructured environment. And I think a critical ingredient in all of this is really getting a leadership, or at least key leaders. In the case of M-Pesa, I think at the time there was between the Treasury's principal secretary, who was fairly relaxed about things like that, and governor of the central bank, who was also quite innovative, or quite open-minded, let what was initially a telecom product sort of evolve into a financial product. And over that period, that's where the moment it was allowed to sort of germinate and find its way, you know, it began to, you know, its own value proposition changed. And in fact, it developed multiple value propositions. It's out of that that we benefited from right now.
Well, that is excellent to hear. It's always encouraging to hear when regulators, treasuries, central banks, and other government agencies have those leaders who are willing to take on new developments, willing to accept change and innovation. Kenya is a clearly excellent example. Here at OMFIF, that's something we're keen on pushing to the forefront, making sure that people understand more about these stories, these experiences, making sure that different policymakers as well can share their experiences. Just a last question then before we finish. What do you see as the next big developments with fintech and financial inclusion in Kenya?
I think we've got both a proof of concept and a proof of market regarding both how mobile money works. We've also got a fairly good sense of its possibilities now because we have a very savvy population as far as this product is concerned. So the way I see that is that I see it evolving into areas where it's been left out of completely. Currently, you're thinking of bonds, how bonds work and how government bonds, the gold standard in any financial sector. I see that now that bleeding into corporate bonds. There's no reason why companies can't also offer an Makiba type bond that is completely mobile based. Now, it may not be for the high end. It may be that there's a particular target group who, for example, can't afford £10,000, but they can afford £1,000. I see companies saying, okay, look, the size of population that can lend us £1,000 is 100 times bigger than the population that can lend us £10,000. So let's craft a product, a mobile product for a particular segment of the market. I see that as a possibility. Other possibilities I see is even how government works. Right now, the notion of virtual government, e-government, one of the key ingredients that have been missing in e-government was what happens to the section of a population that don't have formal bank accounts and are not in the formal economy. Again, I see innovation that even in tax collection would work very well in a system where you reach the sector of population that is not really in the formal sector. See also other financial products, the fintech reaching into insurance, you know, virtual insurance. How does insurance work? How can you help it give access to it? For example, how can you trunk it or chop up insurance products so that it fits into much smaller niche markets in a way that's profitable? And that can only happen because you reduce the transaction cost to a point that you can still make margin, but you'll have to be on a volume. A critical way I see fintech really changing the game is in the notion, is in the whole idea of completely rewriting the book on KYC, know your customer. Because essentially what's happening is a convergence between when you have a transaction history of every citizen, whether or not they are banked. You have a system where it also encourages a cluster. So for example, a savings group of 3 or 4 individuals can come together, come and buy a bond like Makiba, and together over time, build a portfolio as a group. And then at some point, the others distribute that wealth or use that bond as a collateral to start a formal business or to finance a capital acquisition somewhere else. But the key to that is that by the time, what we've seen is that we've had to rewrite the book about know your customer because you can't go through the formal forms and the really long process that you do in a formal market. The question is there a virtual equivalent that is simpler? And you find, yes, there is. And it's easier because the most important question you ask as a financial sector manager is, can your client pay for this? Can they pay back what they borrowed? Am I sure they are not doing funny? They're not laundering money. And fintech in our context is able to simplify that process without necessarily losing visibility. I think it will turn out to be a huge innovation in that space.
Thank you, Waharo. These are really interesting developments that we'll continue to monitor and great insights on what the potential is for fintech to help improve financial inclusion in Kenya. I agree with you. I think the possibility for developing in KYC are massive. And this is something that can be applied to emerging markets as well as developed ones. So, Waharo, I'd like to thank you for taking part in today's podcast. Next week's episode focuses on the digital single market. This will be released and available to download on the OMFIF channel next Tuesday. If you enjoyed the program, Please do subscribe to our channel and leave a review.